Well, welcome everybody. This is Tom Sparrow. And we have someone else joining our call. Who's joining?
Hi, this is Jeff Lineweaver.
Hi, Jeff. Welcome. We're just getting started. And on the line with us today is Patrick Donnelly. Patrick's an architect and a facilitator and involved in all kinds of interesting things. And also is a friend of mine from our church and just socially. And Patrick's been talking to me for a long time about storytelling and authenticity and working in the corporate environment. So, Patrick, welcome. And just tell us a little bit about the kinds of work that you do.
Well, sure. And first off, Tom, thanks for inviting me. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep.
Yep.
I'm on a new fancy schmancy pair of Bose noise canceling headphones. So I'm always checking to make sure my voice is clear because I'm a mobile worker and I'm standing in one of my many offices, which could essentially be wherever I am. Today, I'm standing at a corner window of my house and talking to you all. And I think it's just a fundamental change in the way work is happening today. And I only introduce myself that way because that's pretty much what I do. I'm an architect, a registered architect, and spent many years in my career designing both in my business and now the business that I co-own and help run, which used to be run by my dad. So I'm second generation, large commercial architectural firm, but we've expanded beyond the design of physical architecture to do what I would call organizational architecture. And so it's really changed the way we take design, where we used to use design process and design thinking and apply it to our work with groups of people to uncover the essence of their organization and try to translate their culture or their cultural attributes into spatial attributes that would help them further the success of their organization. We still do that, but what we've done is expanded our work both before and after that lovely act of designing something physical, before we do what I would call business consulting or strategic workplace consulting, which utilizes the power of story to both uncover the essence of an organization and then after the lovely act of designing a physical place, we also use the power of story and storytelling in helping them change. So utilize a space, for example, that was designed to enable greater success, actually help them to understand the intent and the purpose of the design, and then help people actually use the space. Let them in on the secret, right, the design secret of what we were trying to achieve so that it actually brings people closer together and helps them enjoy their work and create better success together. Why am I passionate about that? I mean, if you know this world of work and some of the recent research that's been done by the Gallup organization and others, you know that we're an engagement epidemic. There's probably only 30% of the population, at least in North America, that actually enjoy their work and are engaged in their work. The other 70% is a combination of folks that are indifferent and folks that are actually actively disengaged, people that we would call cave dwellers, constantly against virtually everything, cave dwellers. And the cave dwellers, you're better off paying them to stay home, because they are disruptive and actively really against a lot of what they're trying to achieve within organizations. So we think that our work has a whole lot of purpose now, especially when we're trying to improve people's lives and when you're dealing with people. Certainly a picture is worth a thousand words, and architects know a lot about that and do a lot of that. But creating visual pictures with story actually makes a lot of what we do far more accessible than the abstract act of design. So I'm just thrilled, actually, to be here and to know that you all are doing this work on an organized basis across the world, and just happy to share and talk about whatever you'd like to talk about today and tell a few stories.
Yes. Great. Well, Patrick, I think a good way to proceed would be to actually share one of the stories that you use and talk a little bit about the application. And then if we have time, we'll do some questions and maybe another story. I know we could easily fill our 45 minutes with just you telling stories. But let's start with just one story and how it might be applied. And then we'll open it up to questions.
Well, I'll start with telling a story about myself and how it relates to what I just shared, or transition segue from what I just shared about why I'm passionate about what I do. I mentioned I'm a second-generation architect, and I, prior to joining my father's business, had my own business and actually did design and construction.
Allison Downey.
Hi, Allison.
Oh, hi.
Allison.
So sorry. It asked us to identify ourselves. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, no problem. Allison, Tom speaking right now, and Patrick Donnelly is just starting to share a story with us. Glad you joined.
Thank you.
So my dad, when I was working with him, when I had my own business, and then when I first came back to the firm, I found myself doing something I swore I would never do, and that was work for my father. And yet it's now because of that that my dad and I are so close. It's actually work that brought us much closer together as people, but we're still very different. So an example of that would be that my dad used to say, you know, architecture is a pretty simple business. He said, bricks, mortar, steel, glass, they're inert. You put them together the same way, they react the same way. You get the business, you do the business, you get paid for the work. It's a pretty simple business. But then, tongue-in-cheek, he would say, you get people involved. And the only difference between my dad and I is I finished that sentence by saying, and that's when it gets really interesting. Because without the people, every piece of architecture would be the same. And without the people, you couldn't take architecture and actually enable it to do things like make people's lives better. Because that's what gives you the clue, engaging with the people. So I mentioned before, hello.
Welcome, whoever just joined. Patrick is sharing a little story with us right now. Glad you joined us.
So I mentioned before that in addition to using the power of story to engage and understand our clients and people to help us design, it also helps us after we've designed a space or during that time and as people move in and use it to help them change. And one story that's been helpful to me is a story about Uncle Bill and Bobby. Now, Uncle Bill and Bobby, they love amusement parks. They especially love roller coasters. And Uncle Bill picked up Bobby one day, and they went to the amusement park, and they ran in, and they ran up the ramp to the wooden roller coaster, rolled the roller coaster, ran down the ramp, and Uncle Bill looked at Bobby and said, "So, Bobby, what'd you think?" He said, "Oh, man, that was scary." He said, "Well, what do you mean scary?" And Bobby said, pointing to just under his ribs, "That felt scary." So they went up, ran across the park, ran up the ramp to the metal roller coaster, rode the metal roller coaster, ran down the ramp. Uncle Bill looked at Bobby and said, "So, Bobby, what'd you think?" He said, "Oh, man, that was exciting." He said, "Well, what do you mean exciting?" And Bobby said, pointing to that same spot just under his rib, said, "That felt exciting." So the moral of the story is scared and excited feels the same, so it's better to choose excited. Now, we would typically tell that story showing a video clip of the front seat of a roller coaster and the ride going through the loops and down the roller coaster. And we would use that to talk about change because a lot of resistance to change is about fear, is about being scared. And a lot of the acceptance to change is really about being excited and embracing the change. And what happens in between those two things is knowledge, is learning about what's coming. And so you can see just telling the story would engage people in trying to look past the fear and understand, oh, okay, it's a process. And then we can go into more detailed work on what the process of going through that change might look like. And it opens up conversation with individuals as we go through that. So that's an example of how we might use the story of Uncle Bill and Bobby to talk about change. Any comments on that or questions?
Listen, I love that story. Thank you so much for sharing that. And your focus on navigating change and the challenges that come with it. And I think there's in Paul Smith's book, Lead with a Story, he shares an example, not a similar story, but addressing that same concern, that one of the biggest concerns for people around change has more to do, the fear tends to be about not being prepared for the change. And so
right.
You've got the focus on preparation can relieve stress, and this sounds like you actually have a choice. You can be afraid or you can be excited, and I love that.
I love the way you talk about being prepared for the change. You know, another much longer story, but the essence of the story is really about comparing change to like a family vacation. You know, when you're going on family vacation, think of the kids saying, where are we going to go? Well, what are we going to do? How long are we going to be there? How long is it going to take? You know, what kind of things will we see when we get there? And when you start answering those questions, they can go from being scared of the vacation, I'm not going to have fun, to excited about what might happen. And, you know, we make that same analogy to folks. In fact, I was called on the carpet by a colleague of mine when I was standing at an AA conference talking about some of these issues, especially related to change. And I'd made the comment, you know, it's interesting, the change, it's ever present in our lives. It's amazing how many of us hate change. And during the Q&A, Charlie, one of my colleagues, raises his hand. And he said, Patrick, I really enjoyed everything you had to say, but I must tell you, I really disagree with your comment about change. He said, I think people love change. It's just, I don't think they like the process of change, getting from the current state to the future state. So relating that back to the family vacation, everybody likes to go to the beach, but nobody really likes the drive to the beach. So when you're working on change, change alignment, communication, and management, our job is to make the trip part of the vacation. And to your point, being prepared for that change and using story to do that is helpful.
Yeah, that's a great, great connection. Thank you.
Sure.
And
this
Patrick,
is Dave Brower in Pittsburgh, and I would definitely agree with what you're saying. Your friend is incorrect that people do hate change for a variety of reasons. It's not that they hate this. I mean, there's a lot
of
studies,
Dave,
done in organizational ecology done by Hannon and Freeman and some of these theorists, and it talks about you know, the whole process of inertia and why there is inertia and why people hate change. So there's a lot of academic theory behind the part of hating change, not just the process.
Yeah, some of it is very much human nature. You know, we strive for comfort, peace of mind, and whenever there is change, I think it disrupts that. And so I think the truth lies somewhere in between. I know it's possible, and there can be an excitement associated with it, but it that comes as a result of a lot of other things, I think.
Yes.
And Patrick, in one of your articles, Tom joining back here, it says that people don't people like change, but they don't like to be changed.
Yeah, that's right.
I like that take.
Yeah.
And so that would go ahead.
No, I that's a quote from Peter Senge, and I like it too. I think, you know, we talk about leading people in a process of self-discovery. And the secret to that is helping others. Counselors know this. Tom, in your work, I observe you doing this extremely well all the time and admire it. We're actually, you're helping someone feel as if they're in control, right? But in fact, what you're doing is you're leading them through a process. You're in control of the process. But by the way you embrace what they're going through and what they're doing, and by asking them questions instead of telling them statements, or using story, which is kind of a platform for everybody to have a common experience, they can enter into the process of change. Whereas if somebody tells me, you know, you got to go do this, that's them trying to change me. And I'm pretty resistant to that. But if I'm participative, if I am a part and parcel to the change, then it makes a huge difference to me. And story can really help with that, I think.
Sure.
One of the last places I retired from was Liberty Mutual, and they're in a constant change is consistency for them. And one of the things that I would always tell people that work with me is that if you like what's going on, embrace it because it's going to change. And if you don't like what's going on, don't sweat it. It's going to change.
Yeah, that's really, really terrific.
This is Allison again. You mentioned that you think story can really help with that, and I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind just briefly touching on how you would use story to help with that.
I'm glad you asked.
To help people navigate change. I'm sorry, I didn't finish the sentence.
I appreciate that a lot. We actually use the process of narrative to help people imagine a future state. So we created, for example, a tool. We have a deck of tools, different exercises we do, different methodologies we use, surveys, tools that we use in our work. And one of them, one of my favorites, is a tool called Imagine. And Imagine was created when we were invited in to help the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center change the experience of receiving health care as a child patient, a family patient, or delivering health care as a caregiver. And we faced a challenge because Cincinnati Children's Hospital is consistently one of the top three pediatric systems in the United States year in, year out. So we came in and said, okay, we're going to enter this process and we're going to help make you better. And the doctors and the nurses would say, well, you know, we're consistently one of the top three in the country. How are you going to make us better? What, are you some kind of healthcare expert? And I'm like, no, I'm an innovations guy. I don't really do healthcare. I mean, they wanted to give me a swift kick right out the door. So we took a step back and we said, okay, so what do they really care about? How are we going to help them in this process where we know we can use the facilities to help this delivery better? That's one of the things they hadn't utilized before. It was physically a typical hospital, you might see. So we said, okay, so let's engage the kids because everybody cares about the kids. I'm like, well, how can we make the kids part of the design process? So I went to my wife, Patty, who's a first grade teacher, and I said, well, what would you do? And she said, well, I'll tell them a story. Is that what you would do? Yeah, she said, I would tell them a story. And I'm like, you mean like how to get better health care? She said, no. I mean, if you want them to have a great experience there, ask them about where they've had a great experience. Or what are the qualities of that special place? So we wrote these narratives, and we would have these focus groups with kids, some chronically ill, in bed, participating in these focus groups. And we would lead them through a narrative. You're on your way. Close your eyes. You're on your way to your favorite place. You're so excited. You get there. Tell me about this place. What is it like? Why do you like it so much? And we engaged them. It was interesting. It was fun. But it also got us to realize these are the things that make them interested and excited. And we started to uncover these ideas around things we could do that would make it easier to wait or to make them less scared, everywhere from putting pictures on the underside of a canopy because a small child would be reaching up to hold the hand of an adult and would see the picture of a butterfly on the ceiling, and it would distract them. It would take their mind off of what was going on. Dozens of ideas like that. Well, this tool, and I think I am answering your question, actually, is one of those ways that we use that, and now we've started using it in that case with the parents. The parents said, well, can we do that? We said, yeah. And then the nurses said, well, the parents, could we do that? And then the doctors and the administrators. And then we started using this narrative, this imagine session in our regular practice, and it was working better than the other things we were doing with adults. Now, I know many of you, and I know many CEOs and important people think you can't accomplish really smart, important business with a crayon in your hand. But I beg to differ because we've gotten a whole lot out of this. I actually just pulled up an example of how we would use this with folks. So here's an example. This is a work process imagine. So trying to help someone change the way they work, and this is the imagine. We start out with a quote from T.S. Eliot, "Only those who will risk going too far can possibly find out how far one can go." So I invite you to close your eyes. Remember a time in your life when you were most effective at what you were doing. The quality of your actions was very high. Your concentration was intense. You may have lost track of the time passing. You were in the zone. It's possible you were with others during this experience, and the connection between you and others was very strong. You could rely on them, and they, in turn, trusted you. Where were you? Who were you with? What tools did you have? When were you doing this? Why were you doing this in this way? And how has that memory affected you today? Now project yourself into the future. And it goes on from there. So you can use that first part as an imagine. And they, okay, open your eyes. And the way this works is you get a big sheet of paper, you get crayons, and you do what we call ideation or ideograms. They're not drawings of what a place looked like, or you know, we're not asking people to illustrate like an architect might. In fact, my ideograms have stick figures and lollipop trees, stuff like that. But what it does is it then gets you to use that part of your brain. And actually, there's good science behind it. It comes from, I found it in Tim Galway's work and others, where he talks about when you use visualization, you access a different part of your mind, which then causes you to really develop and understand a problem or make a solution or develop a solution in a different way. And it helps you with innovation. That's been our experience with this methodology, is you actually get people to go to a new place and think about a problem in a different way. And quite frankly, a whole world of ideas opened up when I started talking to Tom about appreciative inquiry. And now that's become an important part of what we do today, where you don't even look at the problem at all. You start looking for solutions right away, places where things are actually happening, and you can scale that up within an organization. So I know that's a very long answer to a pretty simple question, but it was a great question, and we've actually developed tools because we can't just kind of walk in and begin to apply this. The tools themselves, like the hammer in your toolbox, enables you to do something that you can't just do with your bare hands, if you know what I mean.
Thank you so much. That's a great answer.
Oh, great. I'm glad.
What do you tell them to do with the big crayons when you're doing the ideation?
So we set a blank sheet of 11 by 17 sheet of paper, and then they have all these crayons and stuff, and I usually tell them, you know, when I did this with the Boy Scouts, you know, I told them this is going to be a lot of fun, but it's just like the Boy Scouts. It's fun, but it's serious business. I tell them a little bit about the science and then tell the story, and then we say, okay, now take the crayons and just whatever came to your mind while you were listening to the narrative, just put that down, however it comes, words, phrases, pictures, diagrams, however you saw that in your mind's eye, just put that down on the paper. And I'll usually show some silly sketch that I've done that's really ridiculous, you know, a poor artistic representation of someone from first grade, you know, and then it usually frees them up, right, to say, oh, okay, well, he's not asking me to make a pretty picture. He's just wanting me to get my ideas down. And it's pretty amazing what folks will come up with. And we try not to give too much definition, but we may show an example just to keep them from getting too hung up and have to use words right away. after we do that, we go around the room and each person will describe their picture. We'll then convert that into language by putting it on post-it notes or scribe it on a sheet of paper. We tend to like post-it notes because when we convert it to language, we can put those up. And then what we'll do is after everybody's shared, we'll take all those post-it notes and we'll filter and sort them into common themes and we'll show them live how all of their ideas can come together around what we like to call a drive to five. Five common themes from the ideation of a whole group of people that talks about what that Imagine session signified, you know, what success might look like to that group relative to a question that we've asked. So these are tools that we use just to get folks working and thinking together. I think collaboration is it for us, because we don't design buildings for a single individual. We design them for groups and organizations. It's a great way to do public process and collaboration in a way so people can see and watch their ideas path to a solution or to the design of something.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Patrick, Tom here. There's a question I have, and I'm wondering if you ever use a story somehow to convey this. Well, and I think facilitating the aha moments. And by the way, I just love that whole idea of from the ta-da to the aha. That
yeah,
from the mind shift guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But one of the other things that I'm interested in is you talk about, like, in meetings, generally you have people listening critically. So somebody says something, and then everybody analyzes it and picks it apart or gives their own choice versus listening creatively.
Yeah.
Maybe you could just describe a little bit of the difference between listening critically and listening creatively and how you would create a container so that people can listen creatively. And also, you know, is story ever a part of that?
That's a great question. Comment and two-part question. Let me see. Thank you. Yeah, from performing the ta-da to facilitating the aha is also actually a little bit of a jab at my fellow architects, because we have a tendency as a profession to perform the ta-da a lot. What would you like for me to do? You tell me, I go design this beautiful sculpture that I think is cool. I sell the idea, ta-da, you know, which is far different than facilitating a group through what I just described in a Imagine session and using that content humbly to actually design something that really is their idea, and I'm just the translator of it. This idea of listening, what you talked about, I call listening for possibilities. And it really comes out of the fact that I'm allergic to unproductive meetings, right? I tend to break out in a rash and need to leave immediately to seek relief. And part of this came from the author Scott Hunter, and he and I were speaking at the same conference, and I went to his talk, and he talks about what typically happens and why people mostly hate meetings. Is as soon as someone presents an idea, everybody else listens to see whether or not they agree with it and with what was presented, and then it's pretty likely they don't. So someone invariably, like, makes an idea, their idea, presented, and shows how the other one was wrong and tries to sell people on their contrary point of view. So once this is done, like, everyone jumps on the bandwagon and the meeting turns into a series of conflicting points of view and everybody's arguing and why their solution is the right one or the best one. And that sort of combative, debative way of approaching things, when you think about your own life and business or organizational structure, you know, we've achieved a lot of things doing that, right? Maybe that's the reason they had the debate team in high school or why we have so many attorneys. I'm Irish, so yes, we have a lot of attorneys, lots of criminals too. So one makes, they say that both come from the same profile.
Are they mutually exclusive from each other?
No, they're all one big team. At least the cops and the criminals are. the attorneys and the politicians might be a better way of thinking about that. Now, listening for possibilities is different. I mean, listening for possibilities, Scott Hunter would say it's about managing your internal conversation. So the alternative totally stops the previous from happening. And it typically results in ideas and innovations, things that no one could have predicted. So the alternative is to have everyone in the meeting put their own attention on whoever presents the first idea and the next idea, and manage their internal conversation differently, asking the question, rather than do I agree with this, ask the question, what would make that happen? What could make that possible? And that's why I call it listening for possibilities. I'll often send a blog that I wrote on this out for a meeting where we're doing some intense collaboration, where I don't want it to be diminished by this critical thinking, encouraging people, and I'll remind them, did you read that at the beginning of the session? Do you understand that? Can everybody manage their own internal conversation and ask the question, what could make that possible? And what tends to happen is one idea builds on the next, and you don't get into this debate on what these limited ideas are, on who's right and who's wrong. But what you end up with is more abundance mentality rather than a scarcity mentality. He's wrong, I'm right. Abundance mentality is what could make it possible, if that makes sense. And it's funny how you can just plant an idea in someone's mind, like listening for possibilities or a way to manage that internal conversation differently. And people will come to me afterwards and they're like, wow, I didn't even like so-and-so in previous meetings, but now I see that we think, you know, in similar ways about certain things because I was able to what we call suspend judgment, right, just for a time.
When you work with your clients, do you directly say, I'm going to use storytelling now or I have a story? Do you find resistance to that? Do you have to do that very discreetly or always use, you're going to share a narrative episode right now? Talk a little bit about using storytelling in your work.
Well, it's interesting. And Tom, you know, just I've mentioned this to you, just walking and talking with you and with friends of ours like Jim Willick and others who, you know, were great storytellers, I began to realize, you know, I'm Irish. I mean, I have a certain capacity for that myself. And then I started listening to conversation, and it's amazing to me how much conversation, just regular conversation, if you're sensitive to it, actually incorporates story or experience from people.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm hearing a lot of, yeah, there you go.
Music. Yeah, I'm not sure what happened there.
That was outstanding, really, that music. It's amazing how often people will tell a story, this is what I experienced or this is what happened to me. And then I became sensitive to that. And I find myself just being a little bit more, it's not like I've written down all my, it kind of amazes me actually. It's not like I've written down all my stories somewhere and I go through the story Rolodex and, oh yeah, that's in the R folder, you know, and then I access that folder. What I find myself doing is listening for possibility when other people talk, and my mind will just go to a story that I've used before that relates to what they're talking about. Now, there are other times, to your point, where we'll be very calculated about the way we use a story, like Uncle Bill or Bobby, or we'll create a narrative, like for an Imagine session. Or I'll plant a story in a presentation I'll give. So I'll give you an example. I do a lot of just talks now and a lot of teaching in professional organizations. And so I would go to see or listen to, you know, really good speakers that I thought, you know, were entertaining and great. And I'm like, how can they do that? And I realized they typically do one of two things. And try this out for yourself. Maybe you have already. Go to you know, hear someone give a talk, an inspirational talk, and they'll either take like three to five stories, and they'll tell each story, and in between each story, they'll give you the content of what they've been asked to talk about. So you'll remember the stories, and the content will be enriched or enlivened by the fact that they've told a story. Or they'll do just the opposite. They'll give you some content, and they'll say, now I'm going to tell you a story. And they'll tell you a story that applies the content and provides a segue between one lesson block and the next, or one topic to the next topic, or one topic to the next point that they're trying to make. And it was almost very consistent. The speakers, at least that I liked, would integrate story in that way all the time. So now when I plan to give a talk, I will generally start off with a story. Books do this. They'll take a quote, and they'll start a chapter with a quote that'll sink your mind into, oh, what is that quote? What does he mean by that quote, or why is that quote there? And then the chapter will flow from there. It's the same sort of thing. Otherwise, you know, talks and stories and books would all be textbooks, and there wouldn't be fiction, right? It's a way of bringing fiction, or the art of storytelling that you all know far more about than I do, to this level of actually being informative. And I guess the other piece of that to me is I'm aware of, you know, the difference in the way people learn. Like there's visual learners, there's audio learners, and then there's kinesthetics. And I always thought as an architect I was a visual learner. But as I've grown to become a kinesthetic, or maybe I've always been that, but I learn by doing, right? Well, what a story does is a story itself can really reach visuals and audios and kinesthetics equally. And I think that's why it's so important in teaching. And that's, I think, why I enjoy public speakers that do that so much. And so many people, regardless of the way they learn, can get engaged with that. Mm-hmm. Does that address what you were talking about, Tom?
Oh, it does. I was wondering if, you know, like when you're talking with clients or your colleagues in your firm,
mm-hmm.
do you often talk, okay, we need to insert a story here, or sell it by directly using storytelling, the word? I'm just wondering if, you know, for the benefit of our group, what experience do you have about actually talking about storytelling, or do people have to use the phrase narrative?
No, we use the term storytelling. It actually started, I did about 20 months of research on what we call the power of story. And it actually started with a colleague of mine, actually a client of mine, and I read this article from the Harvard Business Review years ago. Krupper was the author. Peter Krupper, I think, called The Four Truths of the Storyteller. It was in the Harvard Business Review, and I'm like, mm-hmm. Really? So we read that, and we got so intrigued by it that our professional organization actually asked us to go out and do that. Relative to using the term storytelling, not originally. I think people, you know, were listening to the idea of the power of story because, you know, I would so often talk about Jim Lohr, who wrote the book, The Power of Story, and, you know, talked about the importance of aligning the stories we tell outside an organization with those we tell inside an organization to create something we call full engagement. Well, engagement is something that through workplace we were really intrigued by. But I think the transition happened when people started to realize they could use story to actually help them, for example, sell an idea, or to your point, in sort of a sales situation when we're presenting our ideas for a new project, I encourage our team to not get too focused on what the tactical content is that they're trying to convey, but just tell a personal story about themselves. Because that enables the other people that they've met that are listening to them, that they're presenting to, connect with you as a person. And it's pretty interesting, you know, how good people can be at telling a personal story about something that excites them and is just, you know, thrilled them to no end about their profession. So an example would be our chief interior designer is, she's not... a natural storyteller. I mean, she's quiet, introverted, exceptionally good designer. But we were pursuing this big corporate project, and I asked her to tell a personal story about herself. And this is the story she told. She said, I was on site one day, and a woman came up to me who worked there for this client. She said, are you the designer? And she said, well, yes. Why do you think so? Or she was ready for her to complain about something, she said. And you work with Pam Morris, our CEO. She said, yes, I work directly with her. She said, well, I just wanted to thank you. I wanted to thank you for saving my marriage. And Pam's like, well, you're welcome, but how could I have saved your marriage? I just designed this building. She said, well, I used to come to work, and I used to be just so tired. It was difficult to get anything done, and I wasn't connecting with my colleagues. And when I would go home, it would affect how I interacted with my family. But today I come into work, into this light-filled, beautiful place, and I have an environment where it's easy to connect with my colleagues. And I actually, work gives me energy rather than taking it away. And when I go home and I interact with my family, I'm not tired. I'm not angry. I'm not frustrated. I can interact with my family in a different way. Thank you for saving my marriage. Oh, my God. I mean, I'd never heard her tell that story before. But the colleague that was with her that day followed that by saying, she's not making this up. I was there. She actually thanked her for saving her marriage. You know, that's just a personal story. And you could talk about the color of the glass or the size of the bricks, you know, or the amount of fresh air that goes through the space. But it's not as powerful as that story, you know.
Yeah. Well, Patrick, thank you so much. We're at our 45 minutes here.
You bet.
Just interesting to hear your perspective on all this and get a little taste of all your wisdom. If anybody has a question and if they wanted to email you directly, is that okay?
Absolutely. Go ahead and you can circulate my email, I'd be happy to respond.
There was some contact information at the end of your article.
You know what? It is. It is there.
Yeah. So, everybody, feel free to do that. From experience, Patrick gets lots of emails, and he doesn't always respond to them. So if you do have a question,
you might have to follow up with a second one if you haven't heard from me.
Or
be patient.
Talk to me, and I can help. But thanks again, Patrick, and thank you, everybody, for joining the call.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Patrick.
Thank you, Patrick. This was great. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Patrick.
You bet.